On the morning of September the 11th, 2001, I woke up in a hotel room in Las Vegas. I'm not in the habit of watching breakfast TV, but when I went down to the lobby, I kind of gathered from what I could see that something had happened. So I went back to the room and switched on the TV, and I saw the events of that day unfold. And the question I was asking myself is the question that I guess everyone was asking themselves, which is, how could such a thing have happened? How did this happen? And over the next few years, I came to discover the answer to that question. Essentially, as we know, a group of 19 mostly Saudi terrorists hijacked aircraft. Two of those aircraft were flown into the Twin Towers in Manhattan, and those aircraft impacts and the resulting fires caused the Twin Towers to collapse. So these are things that I take myself to know, and I hope they're things that you know as well. So in what sense is this a question of knowledge? I mean, what would it take for me to know that aircraft impacts and the resulting fires caused the towers to collapse? Now, of course, to answer that question, we need to say what knowledge is, and that's a big topic in philosophy. So I'm just going to very dogmatically state a few claims about what I think knowledge is, right, and then use those claims to illuminate the case of the Twin Towers. Okay, so for me to know that aircraft impacts caused the towers to collapse, for me to know that that's the case, it must at least be true that aircraft impacts cause the towers to collapse. I can't know it if it isn't true. I mean, I can believe it if it isn't true, but I can't know it if it isn't true. A second condition for knowledge is a confidence condition. For me to know that this is what happened, I must be at least reasonably confident that that's what happened. I don't need to be absolutely certain, but I need to be reasonably confident that this is what happened. Some philosophers prefer not to talk about confidence, they prefer to talk about belief. So in order for me to know that this happened, I must at least believe that it happened. Right? But I think the notion of confidence better captures the notion of knowledge. Okay, and the third condition on knowledge, or a third condition on knowledge, is this. Not only must I in fact be confident that that's what happened, my confidence must be justified. Okay, I mean, supposing I'm a really superstitious person and I walk under a ladder, and I'm very confident that something terrible is going to happen to me. Right? Well, I might be confident, but my confidence isn't justified. I mean, even if something terrible does happen to me, I wasn't justified in my confidence. Okay, so a knower is someone who not only is confident that something is the case, they're warranted, they're justified in being confident. Okay, and then you might ask, well, in what sense is one justified? So in this case, and indeed in many other cases, I want to say that I'm warranted, I'm justified in being confident that the collapse of the towers was caused by aircraft impacts because I'm relying on reliable sources in arriving at that view. Okay, so I base my confidence on information derived from reliable sources, that's what makes my confidence justified or warranted. I mean, there's actually more to justified confidence than that, but that's the basic idea. Okay, now, of course, as we all know, we live in a world in which there are numerous conspiracy theories about all sorts of things, including conspiracy theories about 9/11. Okay, there's any number of such theories, but perhaps the most famous conspiracy theory about 9/11 says something like this. It isn't possible, according to the laws of physics, allegedly, it isn't possible for aircraft impacts to cause the towers to collapse. Okay, so lots of conspiracy theorists think that. Aircraft impacts couldn't have brought down the towers. What did bring them down was a controlled demolition. Okay, so the most popular conspiracy theory says that American government agents or Israeli agents or whatever your favorite conspiracy is went into the towers prior to the attacks, planted explosives in the building, and somehow miraculously detonated these explosives just at the point that the aircraft came onto the scene. These explosives are what caused the towers to collapse. That's just one example of a conspiracy theory, and of course there are, you know, countless others about this subject and many others. So the question I want to ask is this: how should we respond to such theories? Right? And I'm not going to presume to say anything about how you should respond. So I'm going to talk in the first person, right, about how I should respond to these theories. So I want to distinguish between two broad approaches to conspiracy theories. Okay, the first approach is confrontation. Okay, so the first approach, what I need to do when confronted by these theories, which I take to be false, is to try to rebut them, right, to demonstrate their falsity. Okay, that's the rebuttal strategy. The second and alternative strategy, which has been recommended by a very famous philosopher called Saul Kripke, the second strategy is the strategy that says, don't engage with these theories, ignore them. Don't engage with them, avoid them. Okay, so that's the second strategy. So what I want to do in the time available to me is just to think a bit more about the pros and cons of these different strategies, these different approaches. I mean, the one possibility I'm not considering is that I should just believe these theories, right? I mean, of course, that's a position in logical space, right? Which I don't wish to occupy. Right? Well, some of you might wish to, but I don't. Okay, so let's just consider the rebuttal approach. Okay, now here we run into a kind of really basic problem that I think we all face, even those of us who want to be responsible about these things. And the problem that we all face is that most of us don't have the expertise ourselves to rebut these theories in any detail. Okay, I mean, with respect to 9/11, I mean, some of you will know that lots of the debates about what happened on 9/11 have turned on claims based on claims about structural engineering. Right, so there are all sorts of questions about, you know, given the construction of the towers and the temperature at which metal melts, is it possible that aircraft impacts caused the towers to collapse? Okay, now I'm not a structural engineer. I'm not in a position to rebut claims of a conspiracy theorist to the effect that, well, it's not possible for aircraft impacts to have caused the towers to collapse. Okay, so my problem is lack of expertise. Okay, and this is a kind of just general problem that we face with conspiracy theories. So here's another conspiracy theory. Okay, so there's a conspiracy theory about the Holocaust, which is that the Holocaust is a myth. It didn't really happen in the way in which it's said to have happened. There were no gas chambers in Auschwitz. A whole lot of stuff about the Holocaust. Now, again, I mean, I take all these conspiracy theories to be completely false and indeed grossly offensive, right? But I'm not a historian. I don't actually have the link. For example, I don't have the ability to read the German documents, which would actually demonstrate the falsity of these theories. Okay, so here's a kind of practical problem. I mean, rebuttal sounds good. It sounds really good to me, right? But in most of these cases, I don't have the expertise to actually do it myself. Now, of course, you might then say, well, yeah, okay, you don't have the expertise, but surely there are experts out there that you can rely on. Okay, so in the Holocaust case, for example, I might go and read, indeed, as I have read, Richard Evans's work on the Holocaust, right, which I, you know, seems to me to conclusively rebut conspiracy theories about the Holocaust. Right? On 9/11, I might read the report of the 9/11 Commission, various other documents. Right? So I might appeal to experts to settle this question. But of course, the conspiracy theorist is not going to accept any of this. Right? The conspiracy theorist is going to say, well, these people, these experts and their pronouncements are, of course, all part of the conspiracy. Okay, so that's at least a kind of challenge that one faces in these cases. Now, I'll come back later on to whether that's a serious worry or not, but I think it's worth pointing out that trying to shut the conspiracy theorist up by saying, look, here are all these experts who've shown you to be wrong. I mean, just as a matter of fact, it's just highly ineffective as a method for shutting these people up. It doesn't work. Okay, now I'll come back to these questions about rebuttal later on. But they're just some initial problems. Okay, the main one being lack of expertise. So that there's another approach to conspiracy theories, which I want to spend a little bit of time on. So this is an approach which says that the appropriate response to these theories is simply to avoid them or ignore them, not to engage with them. Now that is, in philosophy, that's known as dogmatism. Okay, now dogmatism sounds, I mean, in general, we tend to think that dogmatism is a bad thing, right? But the philosophers the particular philosopher who recommends this approach actually thinks that in some cases dogmatism is good, right? That it's in fact rational to be dogmatic in certain cases. Okay, so why is that? How can dogmatism be a rational response to conspiracy theories? Okay, so let me just characterize what I mean by dogmatism. So just to get the formulation right. So we're now on the handout four. Okay, so dogmatism is the policy of avoiding or ignoring views that I don't know how to refute. It's the policy of avoiding or ignoring views that I don't know how to refute if these views are at odds with what I already know. Okay, so here's an example. What I already know is that aircraft impacts brought down the Twin Towers, so I'm therefore justified in ignoring or avoiding views that are at odds with that. I already know that the Holocaust really happened, so the dogmatic policy is the policy of avoiding or ignoring views or evidence or whatever it is that are supposed to call that into question. So why is that? How can that be a rational policy? How can dogmatism be appropriate? So here's one way of explaining it. Supposing that I'm not an expert about 9/11, I believe the official account, but I'm no expert. Supposing I immerse myself in the work of conspiracy theorists, right? So maybe I spend lots of time on conspiracy websites, I read lots of books by conspiracy theorists, I generally just expose myself to a lot of this stuff. Okay, so what's going to happen? Right, well, here are two things that might happen, both of which are rather troubling. Okay, one thing that might happen is that I just lose my confidence in my original belief. Right? So I used to think that aircraft impacts caused the towers to collapse, but now I'm reading all this stuff, I'm not so sure. Right? Okay, and the more of this stuff I read, the less sure I am. Okay, so what can happen in these cases is that I lose my confidence. I was confident that a certain thing happened, and now I'm not confident. Now, if you think that confidence is a condition for knowledge, then what's happened is that I've lost my knowledge. I started out knowing that aircraft impacts caused the towers to collapse. Now I don't know. Okay, and the point I want to emphasize is that the facts haven't changed. Right? Let's suppose, for the sake of argument, that aircraft impacts really did cause the towers to collapse. Okay, given that I've lost my confidence in that story, I've lost my knowledge even if aircraft impacts did cause the towers to collapse. Okay, so that's one possible consequence. I mean, similarly with the case of, with other conspiracy theories. prolonged exposure to these theories can actually affect one's levels of intellectual confidence in what is the case. Okay, another possibility is this. Supposing that I engage with these theories, I spend lots of time reading them, I don't know how to refute them, but I remain confident in my original view. Okay, so supposing I'm just kind of stubborn, right? So I continue to hold on to my original view, regardless of my inability to refute these theories. Okay, but then the question is, well, do I have the right to be confident now? I mean, a natural thought is, look, if you don't know how to refute these views, and these views are a direct challenge to your own view, how can you be right to still be confident in your own position? Okay, so either way, I can end up not knowing something that I previously knew. Okay, so I started out knowing that something happened on 9/11, namely that aircraft impacts caused the towers to collapse. I started off knowing that in the sense that it was true, I was confident, and I had the right to be confident. Now, as a result of prolonged exposure to conspiracy theories, I'm no longer confident, and or I no longer have the right to be confident. Okay, so I've gone from knowing to not knowing. Right, that's why I talk about disappearing knowledge. My knowledge has disappeared. Right? My knowledge has disappeared. Just to repeat, my knowledge has disappeared not because the facts have changed. The facts haven't changed. Right. What's changed is me. Roughly speaking, my epistemic standing has changed. Okay, so Kripke's idea is that, well, I mean, given that that's the risk that you run by immersing yourself in the conspiracist literature, given that that's the risk that you run, the best thing you can do to protect your knowledge is simply to ignore this stuff. Right? Don't read it. Don't engage with it. No good can come of it. Right? Because you, after all, ex hypothesi, you're not going to be able to refute it. Right? You're not going to be able to refute it because you're no expert. But if you can't refute it, what's the point of engaging with it? I mean, all that can possibly happen, I mean, the only thing that can happen is that you end up being less certain or less confident than you were at the beginning. Right. So if you knew at the outset that the towers are brought down by aircraft impact and you want to preserve your knowledge, right, then the most effective way of preserving your knowledge is just not to read this stuff, to tell them to get lost. Okay, that's dogmatism. Okay, so on this account, dogmatism, or if you prefer, close-mindedness, is serving a valuable intellectual function. Right? The intellectual function that is being served by these, what you might otherwise think of as intellectual vices, the intellectual function of these vices is actually to protect our knowledge. I mean, there are some things to which it is better to close your mind. Right? Intellectual virtue does not require you to keep an open mind about everything. It does not require you to keep an open mind about the reality of the Holocaust, right? For example. It does not require you to keep an open mind about what happened on 9/11 or any number of other things like that. Okay, so I think it's possible to see that the dogmatic approach has, well, I mean, it has its attractions, right? I mean, there seems to be latching onto something quite important and something quite interesting. So the question I want to ask myself is this: I mean, should we be dogmatists? Should we be dogmatists? Is that actually a good policy? Okay, well, I think the answer is no. I think the answer is no. I don't, in the end, think we should be dogmatists. And then we seem to have a dilemma. Right? The dilemma is, I mean, somebody might say, okay, hang on, so you don't want to be a dogmatist. Okay, I get that. Right? But the alternative to dogmatism is to, you know, engage with these people and try and show that they're wrong, but you've already agreed you can't do that. Okay, so what's left? What's left? Assuming that you aren't going, I mean, assuming that you don't end up believing these things, these theories, it seems as though, you know, I'm stuck. Right? And I want to say that this is actually a situation that we all face all the time. Right? And I mean, I've talked about conspiracy theories, but you might want to say the same thing about fake news. I mean, what is the point of all this? I mean, what is the point of fake news? What is the point of these conspiracy theories? And I it seems to me that part of their point is to shake our confidence in our beliefs about the way the world works. I mean, part of the point of these theories is to make us think that, oh, well, I mean, who knows? I don't know. You know, it could be. How do I know? Right, so the whole point of these theories is to instill in us a deep sense of kind of uncertainty, right? So that even things that might seem to us to be absolutely fundamental end up feeling quite shaky. And neither of the two options that I've discussed seem straightforward. Okay, so let me now just say briefly why I think the dogmatic approach isn't the right approach. I mean, what's wrong with dogmatism? I mean, the first thing that's wrong with dogmatism, it seems to me, is that it's really a form of intellectual cowardice. I mean, that's the first thing that's wrong with it. If you take something like, you know, Holocaust denial, I mean, I think it's extremely important as responsible citizens that we don't allow these things to go unchallenged. I mean, they need these pernicious theories need to be challenged. They need to be shown to be false. And it's not good enough just to say, well, you know, they let them get on with it. I'm not going to do anything about it. Okay, so I mean, that's one thing. I mean, the dogmatic approach that Kripke outlines, I think, you know, there's a heavy price to be paid for this, right? And the heavy price is just allowing these people to get away with it. I mean, so they can just live in their own bunker, you know, reinforcing each other's crazy views about the Holocaust or whatever it is. And we're supposed to just stand back and say, hey, it's not my, you know, that's fine. I don't believe it, but it's not my problem. Well, it is my problem, right? I mean, it's all of our problem. I mean, it's a problem for all of us, I think, that people are out there propounding these views. And after all, I mean, it's quite common for people to say, oh, isn't it terrible that people believe these conspiracy theories? But if you think it's terrible to believe these conspiracy theories, then, you know, you need to be arguing against them. You can't complain that people believe them if you yourself can't be bothered to say what's wrong with them. I mean, that's a kind of a first pass at saying why the dogmatic approach seems unsatisfactory. Of course, another worry about the dogmatic approach is that it would also lead you to avoid or ignore some conspiracy theories which turn out to be correct. I mean, you know, imagine, go back to 1974, okay? So just, I don't know, January 1974. So you read all the stuff in the Washington Post written by Woodward and Bernstein about the Watergate conspiracy. Okay, so imagine a dogmatist back then saying, well, I'm just going to avoid this. These are just conspiracy theories. I'm going to ignore them. Well, that wouldn't have been a very good policy, right, in that case, because there actually was a Watergate conspiracy. Okay, another concern about the kind of blanket dogmatism, refusal to engage is that it could lead you to not engage with theories that actually in the end have some merit. Okay, so I mean that's a further challenge, which is, well, you know, then can we distinguish then between, you know, good conspiracy theories and bad conspiracy theories? Right? Now, I mean, that sounds like a rather kind of flip way of putting it, but I mean, obviously, there is a distinction, right? I mean, Woodward and Bernstein's theory was actually really, really good. And not just because it was true, right? I mean, it wasn't just that. They actually had really good evidence. I mean, they had a fantastic source, right? He was called Deep Throat. That's where this stuff was coming from. So that's another kind of worry about the dogmatic approach. And the last thing I want to say is that, I mean, even if I refuse to engage with these theories, I mean, I know they're out there. Right? So how can burying my head in the sand protect my knowledge once I know that they're out there? I mean, somebody might say, look, you know, you have these beliefs about what happened on 9/11, and you know there are people out there who put forward theories that are directly at odds with your beliefs. Okay, so you can't protect your beliefs by saying, I'm not listening. Right? Because the whole point of these theories that are out there is to question your right to be confident. Right? Is to question your right to be confident that aircraft impacts brought down the Twin Towers. Right? So your right to be confident is already been questioned. Right? I wouldn't go so far as to say it's the mere existence of these theories that calls your right into question, but the existence of these theories plus your awareness that they exist. I mean, you might not know the details of them, but there's already a challenge to your knowledge which can't be dealt with just by blocking your ears. Okay, so I think this brings me back to the rebuttal option, right? And I want to suggest that actually the rebuttal option has more going for it than I started out with, okay? And I just want to end by making the case for rebuttal. Okay, so the first thing I said, let me just start off with a point about this, which I think is quite fundamental to this whole issue. When I introduced rebuttal as a possible response to conspiracy theories, I talked as if the whole point of rebutting these theories was to convince the conspiracy theorists that they're wrong. Okay, now if that's what you are trying to do, you might as well just pack up your bags and go home. You will never succeed. They are not persuadable. So it's just a mistake, I think, to think that rebutting these theories is a matter of demonstrating to their satisfaction that these theories are no good. Right? Rebuttal is more a matter of demonstrating of establishing to your own satisfaction that these conspiracy theories are no good. And that's a different matter. And something else follows from that. Okay, so early on I talked about experts and the role of experts in all of this. So I said, well, look, you know, I might appeal to, you know, experts to defend my views about 9/11 or whatever it is. And then you might say, oh yeah, but look, your experts are going to be seen as lacking credibility or as part of the conspiracy, right? I mean, what is an expert after all, right, you might want to say. So consider, I mean, a really interesting case. I don't know how many of you have seen the movie Denial, right? But this is a case where this comes up, okay? So on the one hand, you have, you know, pseudo-historian, David Irving, right, who's published all this, you know, masses and masses and masses of books about the Holocaust, all of which, you know, defend a version of Holocaust denial. Okay, and on the other side, you have Richard J. Evans, who's a historian from Cambridge, who's published lots of stuff, taking on Evans, right, and showing that his views aren't right. Now, of course, you might want to say, yeah, but look, it's all relative, right? So, I mean, you know, for a conspiracy theorist, Irving is the expert and Evans is not. For you, maybe Evans is the expert and Irving is not. So, I mean, who's to say what an expert is? Okay, well, what I want to say in reply to that is that is actually a form of epistemic nihilism. Right? I mean, I want to say that actually, who is and is not an expert is not a subjective matter. Right? I mean, there are actual credentials that experts have, that genuine experts have, which non-experts don't have. Okay, so these have to do with training, peer review, track record, and various other criteria for genuine expertise, which in the Holocaust case, it seems to me, clearly mark Evans out as an expert and Irving as not an expert. And similarly, in the case of 9/11, right? So if I want to defend my view of 9/11, or I want to defend my view of the Holocaust, so I started out by saying, well, I'm not an expert. True, I'm not an expert, right? But there are genuine experts out there. I can consult, right, to actually get to the facts about this. Okay, and the response to that is to say, oh, well, but there's no such thing as a genuine expert, right? There's just, you know, your experts and their experts, right? And I want to say that's where you need to resist, right? You need to actually desubjectify the notion of an expert. Okay, so that's the second thing I want to say. Okay, and the third thing I want to say is this. I mean, the conspiracy theorists are very good and, you know, highly effective at denigrating, as it were, our experts. Okay. And then the obvious question to ask is well, what about these guys? Right? What are their credentials? If you think of the average 9/11 conspiracy theorists, I mean, what are they structural engineers? Are they physicists? I mean, some are. I mean, I don't dispute that there are structural engineers out there who defend conspiracy theories about 9/11. But the vast majority of conspiracy theorists have, to put it mildly, no more claim to genuine expertise than I do. And in fact, it's even worse than that. Because actually, I mean, the empirical evidence on conspiracy theories and belief in conspiracy theories is that they're actually underpinned by a conspiracy mentality, which disposes people who have that mentality to believe conspiracy theories in a rather undiscriminating way. Right? So, I mean, there's a very famous paper on this by a couple of psychologists, which actually showed that belief in one conspiracy theory makes it highly likely that you will believe other conspiracy theories, even other conspiracy theories that directly contradict your theory. Okay, so there's this study which showed that, okay, the more you believe that Osama bin Laden was already dead when his compound in Pakistan was attacked, the more you believe that, the more likely you are to believe that he's still alive. Okay. And ditto with Diana, right? There's some, you know, the Princess Diana case. It's a beautiful study, right? An obvious thing to think is, look, I'm not taking lessons from these guys, right? I mean, what are their credentials? Right? What are their credentials? Okay, so there's a kind of mission for experts and non-experts alike. Right? The mission for experts is to actually rebut these theories, not to let them lie, to rebut them, to show whether to use documentary evidence to show that these theories are no good, assuming that they are no good. And for those of us who are not experts, our responsibility as citizens of a democracy, our responsibility is to base our views on the evidence presented by genuine experts. And that is what we can do to rebut these theories, at least to our own satisfaction, even if not to the satisfaction of the conspiracy theorists. Okay, that's it.